During the course of the summer this year, as a side effect, if you will, of the bicentennial of Methodism, a time in which the church and people called United Methodists are looking back upon their tradition and thinking about how that tradition may speak to the present. As a part of that celebration here at Lakeside this summer, I have been pursuing a series of lectures on the general topic of vignettes of American Methodism. And we began here by talking about some of the Wesleyan background, and then we brought it to America and talked about Asbury and Otterbein and Boehm, the founders of the United Brethren, and Dr. Albright, who was the founder of the Evangelical Association, all of which became parts of modern United Methodism. We talked about the assault upon the frontier and the effect that that attack upon the frontier had upon the life of the church and its institutions. We had something to say also about the organizational bent, which seems to be a traditional Methodist bent, in a lecture entitled Organizing to Beat the Devil, as we talked about the institutions the church formed on the frontier and to meet the challenges of America. For in a very real way, the American society has repeatedly set an agenda which the church has had to address. Sometimes that agenda has been a problem of physical undertaking or institutional structure. Sometimes it has been a matter of response to difficulties or response to evil in the society. Thus, last week when we were together here, I was talking about the church and slavery, the church's attempt to deal with the problem of slavery in America and of the black populations in America. Next week, I want to talk about the church and the social gospel. And today, I want to focus upon yet another of the issues which the society has placed before the church and which the church has tried to deal with more or less creatively, and that is the church and the role of women in the early history of American Methodism. Now, the role of women in the history of Methodism is unusually great, and by unusually here, I mean it is greater than is the case in many other denominations. Partly that is because Mr. Wesley became conscious of and became aware of very early the abilities of some of his women as preachers, as advisors and counselors, as class leaders, as the leaders of organizations, schools, and the like. And he tended to encourage them to enter into leadership roles, even into the preaching role itself. And those of you who were with me in the week just past heard me one day talking about Mary Bosanquet and Sarah Crosby, who were women who indeed participated as preachers in the life of the early church in a time, that is the 18th century, when there were women preachers in almost none of the other established denominations of the time. Mr. Wesley traveled widely in England. The number of folk who responded to his messages is variously debated because it's hard to get statistical information that's accurate from the 18th century. However, congregations of 5,000 and 8,000 and 10,000 are reported and apparently legitimately reported. Many, many of those who came to hear Mr. Wesley preach were women. Indeed, our evidence would seem to indicate that the proportion of women in early Methodism probably approached 65% of the total. Again, that's a statistical figure, that's an estimate. I can't document that with exact figures. But when you do have class meeting records, the women always outnumber the men, and outnumber the men fairly substantially. One of the women who heard him preach in Northern Ireland when he was preaching there, and incidentally, he was preaching in German. This is something that we American Methodists don't always realize. Wesley spoke German in his later years as fluently as he spoke English. And when he met German-speaking folk, he naturally conversed with them and preached to them in German. And the community that Barbara Heck came out of was a German-speaking Irish community. That may seem inherently unlikely to you, but there is a historical reason for it. Many German refugees fled the wars of Louis XIV and 17th century, and many of them ended up in Ireland. Some of them eventually came on to America to settle here. Well, Barbara Heck and her husband, as well as Philip Embury, a local lay preacher among the German community in Northern Ireland for the Methodists, migrated to America about 1760. And during the early years of their activity here in America, or of their residence here in America, they do not seem to have done anything that was clearly or distinctly Methodist. Embury had been a preacher in the old country, but he doesn't seem to have preached here for a while. Instead, they joined the local Anglican church in the New York colony. That's Trinity Church. They attended St. Paul's Chapel of Trinity Church down almost at the foot of Manhattan Island, and their names are on the official records of the Trinity Church there. Other Methodists came from the old country, but also there were no organized Methodist services yet in America. One day we are told that Barbara Heck came down out of the upstairs into the kitchen of her home, where her brother and several other former Methodists or erstwhile Methodists from Ireland were, much to her distress, sitting in front of the fire playing at cards. She was shocked at this variation of Methodist piety, and she went over, we are told, and swept the cards into her apron off of the table and dumped them rapidly into the fire that was burning in the fireplace. And she then stumped off down the street to find Mr. Embury. And when she found him, she broke out almost at once, with no preface at all, "Mr. Embury, you must preach to us, for if you do not, we will all go to hell and our blood will be on your head." And under this inspiration, the first Methodist meeting in the colony of New York, and one of the first in America, took place. Later, when they built a building in which they would be able to have their meetings, she whitewashed the walls of the building, and as long as she lived in the city of New York, it was she who kept the chapel clean day after day, as it was necessary to keep it clean. She then moved to upstate New York, and shortly thereafter into Canada, and in the 1780s, she was instrumental in the founding of the first Methodist class meeting in Canada. So Barbara Heck is a remarkable woman, another of that long chain of remarkable women in the history of Methodism. Now, one might think that a church which owed its birth in America to a woman, and which had a tradition in Mr. Wesley's own attitude of being favorable to women preaching, might have been more eager to use the talents of women than its fellow denominations were in the early years in America. Unfortunately, this is not the case. Instead, environmental pressures of the American Frontier Society impressed upon the Methodists newly arrived from America, impressed upon them the subordination of women and tended to encourage the exclusion of women from the ministry. There are rare instances in the early years of the 19th century of women local exhorters and lay preachers, but the circuit rider ministry in a frontier church is not well designed for women. A man circuit rider can go from here to there to there to there and not get home for three months. He can sleep out half the time in a cave or under a heavy tree or something to protect him from the weather, and nobody will comment upon it except to say, "My, what wonderful dedication that he will so labor." A woman in exactly the same situation in the 1820s and 30s, who traveled for 3 months without getting back home again, who slept out several nights along the way, along the side of the road, wherever she could find a place, would not only be risking her virginity, she would also be risking a denunciation of her reputation. Because instead of saying, "My, how dedicated," the members of her society would have said, "I wonder who she was sleeping with." This is a part of the inherent sexism of our society in the way we approach things, and particularly the way they approach things in the 19th century. So it is that a frontier circuit rider ministry was not well designed for a woman to participate. Excluded by circumstances and eventually by law from the itinerant ministry, women discovered that when the church referred to men as leaders of the society, it was not speaking generically, but rather was speaking about male men. In 1872, for instance, when lay men were first enabled to become delegates to the Methodist General Conference, women were elected, it being assumed that women were laymen. No way. Laymen went lay males, according to the General Conference of 1880, and they refused to seat the ladies who had been elected to attend the assembly. Eventually, they began to license some of the women to preach. The first woman preacher of whom we have evidence in America seems to date from 1848. She was a member of the African Union Methodist Episcopal Church. That's not the AME of today. It's a different group, a separate group of black Christians, who apparently, as early as 1813, licensed women preachers. Within the mainline Methodist, that is the Methodist Episcopal, the date is 1848, but even then, there are very, very few of them. And in 1880, when the church suddenly became aware that some of the conferences were actually licensing women to preach, they passed a law that forbade such licensing. And several women who had such licenses had their licenses revoked on them because, after all, you know, St. Paul did say some rather definite things about women being silent in the assemblies of the church. Throughout all of those years, women made up the better than half of the membership of the denomination. Whether they made up the better half or not is at least debatable. They influenced their sons into the ministry. They sustained their husbands who were ministers. They gave their labor entertaining, itinerating ministers. And they gave of their labor and of their substance in a totally incalculable number of church dinners, bazaars, and other money-raising activities, without which many of those early Methodist churches would simply have sunk without any further recognition or any further visibility. Now, it is natural that the women's rights movement in the secular world of the 19th century, following the Civil War, had its churchly concomitants. That is, as there begins to appear in the secular society a concern for women's rights to vote and for women's rights generally, one will begin to find also within the church a growing concern for the role of women. The women in the church won precious few battles if what one is looking for is ordained Methodist women. Almost no ordinations of Methodist women until well into the 20th century. There are one or two exceptions, and I'll mention one of them a bit later. Having said this, however, that is, having said that there were precious few victories as far as ordination was concerned, it would be a major mistake to imagine that Methodist women simply sat at home tending to their stereotypical knitting and did nothing about the activities and the life of the church. Institutions both within and without the church attracted the attention of Methodist women. And in their leadership of these agencies and concerns, Methodist women demonstrated and proved an absolutely superb capacity for leadership and for management and for the practical application of the gospel. They even created bastions of female-led organization and structure within the life of the church itself. Now, in general, such developments of structures within the church itself. In general, such developments take place when a woman recognizes the need of other women, which is not being met by the male-led church, and then insisted that that need be met. And when the male leaders don't respond to the need, they then turn to their fellow Methodist lay women and say, in effect, "What can we do? How can we achieve what obviously needs to be done and what the men are too blind to do?" I want to talk about a number of those women during the remaining portion of our time here today. And you will hear again and again this pattern of women recognizing a problem of women and then seeking to find a way within the structures or outside of the structures to meet that problem and deal with it. And I want to start with a lady by the name of Lois Stiles Lee Parker. Lois Stiles Lee Parker and her husband, Edwin W. Parker, finished their studies in 1859 at the Concord Theological Academy. The Concord Theological Academy was in Concord, New Hampshire. It is the direct ancestor of Boston University School of Theology. 10 years after they graduated, Boston University School of Theology became the founding school of Boston University. So I am quite conscious of Ms. Parker, since she is one of the four mothers, if you will, of the tradition and of the school in which I teach today. In 1859, immediately following their degree work, or his degree work at Concord Academy, they set out for India. And for Mrs. Parker, this was the beginning of a 66-year ministry to the subcontinent of Asia. For except for an occasional year back home on leave, she would spend all of the rest of her life, 66 years, in the service of India. during her first term in India, she became particularly concerned and particularly aware of the need of Indian women and Indian girls for education. It has been estimated that the literacy rate among women in India at the time that she went out was something under 0.5% of the population. The literacy rate for men wasn't all that great, but it was somewhere between 5% and 8% of the population. So obviously, men were being taught, or at least some were, and the missions had already begun to establish schools to teach men to read and write, but women were being ignored, and their difficulties were being ignored. At the end of her 7-year term as a missionary, she returned to America, and in Boston in 1868 and 69, she spoke often on the problem of the Indian woman and of the Indian Christian woman and the leadership of those women. She spoke also about the responsibility of the Methodist women of America to the women of India. Now, it was not long before someone suggested that they might form a society to raise money and recruit missionaries to oversee such work. Founding societies is a traditional Methodist occupation. We have been doing it for years and years and years and years and years. Whenever anybody says there's something wrong, we need to do something about it, we create a committee. And the committee then sets up a financial organization and structure, and pretty soon you've got a little society marching along trying to do what needs to be done. Not wishing to seem to compete with the parent missionary society, which after all already existed in New York and had sent the Parkers out on their first mission undertaking, not wishing to seem to compete with the parent society, they contacted the New York office. And the New York office was delighted. They wrote back encouraging the women to raise all the money they could and send it to New York, where the male leaders of the missionary society made it clear they would be graciously pleased to spend the money. That's not what the ladies had in mind. They felt male eyes in New York too often were blind to female need. That's not because the men in the New York society were men of ill will. It's simply because they're men. And being men, they are blinded to a degree on certain of the problems that are particularly effective or affecting the women of the society. On March 23rd, 1869, the ladies of Boston Methodism were invited to come to the Tremont Street Methodist Episcopal Church there to hear Mrs. Parker and another returned missionary from India talk about the need in India. Now, the day brought one of those heavy windstorms, gully washers, near hurricanes, which Boston frequently gets in the spring. And the result was that only 5 ladies showed up to hear Mrs. Parker speak. Not to be deterred, Mrs. Parker spoke. And again, they did the Methodist thing. They appointed a committee. The committee was to nominate officers and write a constitution. And a few weeks later, a larger group of Methodist women met to adopt the constitution. The purpose was defined as, quote, engaging and uniting the efforts of the women of the Methodist Episcopal Church in sending out and supporting female missionaries, native Christian teachers, and Bible readers in foreign lands. They elected as their president the wife of the longtime dean of Concord Academy and of the Boston University, that is, Mrs. Osmond Baker. Baker had just been elected to the episcopacy, and his wife assumed a position of leadership of the Woman's Society as a result. Mrs. William Fairfield Warren, the wife of the first president of Boston University, was the corresponding secretary of the organization. They began to publish a news sheet at once. The first issue appeared on May 7th, and it bore a rather unfortunate title, a title which it would have for the next 30 years or so, The Heathen Woman's Friend. Well, the emphasis was on friend, let us say, and the word heathen did not have quite the chauvinist connections that you and I think of when we hear the word today. Thus was born what came to be known as the Woman's Foreign Missionary Society of the Methodist Episcopal Church, the WFMS. How many of you remember it? A lot of you do, indeed. A lot of you were a lot of the women here present were active in the WFMS right down until its consolidation into the Women's Society for Christian Service in 1939. Now, as it happened, Mrs. Parker, on her way home from her, on her way to Boston on her leave, had stopped off in Central Ohio to speak. And down in Sinclairsville, Ohio, a young woman by the name of Isabella Thoburn had happened to attend one of her addresses. And Miss Thoburn was much impressed. Her brother James was already a missionary in India, and she had indicated that if the opportunity should open, she, a trained teacher with several years of teaching experience, was ready to go to India. Likewise, Mrs. Parker met a highly trained medical doctor, Clara Swain. And Clara Swain also offered herself, should the finances become available, to go to India to found a hospital that would focus particularly upon the diseases of women and the diseases that are related to childbirth and the raising of children. Within 18 months of the founding of the society, both Dr. Swain and Miss Thoburn were in India. Miss Thoburn would found a college at Lucknow, which today is the Isabella Thoburn College of Lucknow, India. Dr. Swain would found a hospital at Bareilly, which today is the Clara Swain Hospital of Bareilly, India. And both of these institutions now have well over 100 years of service to Methodist women and to women generally in India. There were myriad problems ahead, problems of meeting a need almost beyond calculation, problems of finding and sifting women missionaries, problems of living together with the parent missionary society, for you don't need me to tell you there was a potential scrap a-brewing in this situation. There were many of the male missionary secretaries who were persuaded that every penny that was given to the Women's Foreign Missionary Society was a penny less to be given to the general board. It did not work out that way. It often does not work out this way. When you get a new organization that is enthusiastically promoting a missionary endeavor, it tends to benefit all missionary endeavors. And the money for the General Society went up at the same time that the Methodist Women's Foreign Missionary Society began to raise money as well. But no male missionary secretary in 1870 would have believed that was what was going to happen. A woman sees the need of women in India. And she meets other women and gathers with them to say, how can we solve the problem and deal with the problem? The WFMS grew out of Mrs. Parker's concern for the state of Indian women. There were those who argued, however, that there were women in desperate need of help closer than the Asian subcontinent. That there were women in desperate need of help in the cities and villages and towns of America itself. Particularly was this true in the months immediately following the Civil War, when it seemed to many that the needs of the freedmen and freedwomen of the Deep South were so deep as to be beyond easy or even beyond any solution. You know, it is one thing to emancipate the black, and Lincoln did this with the Emancipation Proclamation, and Congress did it with a series of acts after the Civil War. It is another thing to take a black community of folk who have lived all of their lives in a subordinate economic position where farming meant going out and hoeing or going out and planting at the order of the white master, and you suddenly turn them loose and you say, now you're free, go run your own farms. The first question is, where does the farm come from? And the second question is, even if I had one, how would I run it? Because the black males and the black females had not been trained or educated in farm management. They had been trained or educated to do the dirty work. Well, the church and other societies, organizations also, tried to meet the problem of the freed men by providing training and education and skills and that sort of thing. But relatively few recognized the need of the black women. The problem came to light early in the lower Mississippi River, where the success of the Northern armies after the Battle of Vicksburg left many black women and black men alike free, but quite incapable of exercising their freedom. Sarah Dickey was one of a group of United Brethren missionaries who moved into this area after the fall of Vicksburg in 1862. A school was started which concentrated on reading and writing and religion. The textbook they used was the New Testament in order to teach the children or the young people or some older people how to read. After 19 months, the school was forced to close for lack of finances. But Sarah Dickey, in that 19 months, had found her profession. The experience had convinced her of several things. First, that she was called of God to a ministry to the black women of the Deep South. And second, that she needed more education herself if she was going to succeed in that ministry. At age 27, she resolved to go back to school. So sure was she that Mount Holyoke was the only possible school she could conceivably attend, she didn't apply anywhere else, but simply applied to Mount Holyoke, and indeed she was accepted. Mount Holyoke College was then in its own early days as a bastion of women's education. It was called a seminary, but not a theological seminary. Seminary then meant secondary school for ladies. It would eventually become a college for a few uncommon women, as their catalog so graciously puts it. Still puts it that way, we may say. Sarah Dickey's desires to serve her fellow women were strengthened at the school, and she became persuaded that it was to be her destiny to create a sister school to Mount Holyoke in the Deep South. She returned to Mississippi in 1869 in the midst of the Reconstruction era, when, if anything, Reconstruction had resulted in race relations that were worse than they had been before. She found herself caught between two fires. On the one hand, there were the attacks of the Ku Klux Klan and the social ostracism of the white community. On the other were deep-laid suspicions of the good intentions of white people that were held in the minds of the blacks. The blacks had precious little reason to trust white men or white women, either one. Even in church, she found herself either ignored or insulted. But by 1873, she had her school underway. She called it Mount Hermon, sister to Mount Holyoke. Her support came from many friends. There was no board of missions yet in the United Brethren Church. There certainly was no female board of missions yet. There was no structure to systematically raise money in the North, but she operated on the faith principle, believing that God would provide that which God found necessary and desirable. And in this circumstance, she corresponded regularly with friends of the North to make known what her problems were. She traveled in the North at least for a month or 6 weeks every year and spoke wherever the opportunity arose. The constituency to which she spoke was the United Brethren Church, because that's the people she knew. Those were her acquaintances and friends. She founded a school then, before there were any home mission boards or societies for women on a national level in any of the five churches which would later become the United Methodist Church. But again, the pattern is clear. It is a woman who recognizes a problem of women and then goes to other women to try to solve the problem. In the Methodist Episcopal Church, another case arises of a woman who became concerned initially about the difficulties of the freedwomen, the black women. Her name was Jenny Culver. She was a native of Chicago, a trained teacher, and a young woman who before her marriage had run a very successful class for Swedish immigrant women in Chicago. She taught them how to speak English. She didn't know how to speak Swedish, but she taught them how to speak English. She married Joseph Hartzell, who was later Bishop of Africa, and in 1869, he took her to New Orleans, which wasn't quite Africa. He got her there in due time. But he took her to New Orleans, where he was serving a Northern Methodist church. Now, a Northern Methodist church in New Orleans in 1869 is a black church. There aren't any Northern Methodist white churches in New Orleans in 1869. One evening, Mr. Hartzell was away from home on business, and there was a knock at the door. And when Mrs. Hartzell went to the door, there she found the proprietress of a nearby house of ill fame, which catered to the white man's desire for black women. One of the black girls in this house had become ill. Indeed, she was near death, and she had asked her madam to find a minister for her. The madam had gone from one church to another in the city and been turned down again and again by the ministers who would have nothing to do with a girl in a house of ill fame. She now came to Mr. Hartzell, and Mr. Hartzell being not at home, Jenny went herself. She continued to call on the girl over the course of the next 2 weeks, talking to her of the love of God and the assurance of God's forgiveness, until the girl was converted shortly before her own death. But in the process, Mrs. Hartzell visited a kind of woman in a kind of situation that she had not even dreamed existed. She became acquainted with the need of black women at the very bottom of the societal structure of the city of New Orleans. Other madams heard from the first one that Mrs. Hartzell was concerned or worried or was upset about the situation, and so they would send for her also when a problem arose with one of their girls. Gradually, the black women of New Orleans became the major burden on Mrs. Hartzell's conscience. She longed to send women missionaries into their homes, to hold meetings for young women and for mothers, to train Sunday school teachers, to teach simple home industries, and to urge attendance upon church, and most of all, to communicate the love of Jesus Christ for all sinners. On her own responsibility, she began a missionary school, hired 3 women to work for her, and when the money ran out, she began to write letters to all of her friends, women, back in Chicago. By 1880, there were over 500 girls in that school. And clearly a more solid foundation financially for their efforts was needed. A regularized support agency. Efforts were made to interest the WFMS, the Foreign Missionary Society, but the Foreign Missionary Society said, "We're spending all the money we can raise in India and in China." Efforts were made to attach to the Freedmen's Aid Bureau, but the Freedmen's Aid Bureau's response was to make quite clear, "Yes, we are happy to have your support and have you raise money for us, but we will decide where the money will be spent." The same thing that Mrs. Parker had heard a few years earlier. Some hope was expressed that the 1880 General Conference would help, but when that conference failed to act, in June of 1880, after General Conference, 50 ladies of Cincinnati met to discuss what might be done. The major address was given by Mrs. Hartzell, who pled for the formation of a Woman's Home Missionary Society parallel to the Women's Foreign Missionary Society. Others present urged that the society be concerned not just with black women, but with white women of Appalachia, of the slums of the cities, and of the like. And the result was the formation of the Woman's Home Missionary Society, Woe Home Miss, the lodge up diagonally across from the church here in Lakeside, is named for that Woman's Home Missionary Society. The first president of the society was the wife of the President of the United States of America. Her name was Lucy Hayes, Rutherford B. Hayes' wife. She lived over here in Fremont. As some of you know, perhaps you have visited her home at the Hayes Memorial. From German Methodism came an institution that was adopted in America to make easier the recruitment of women workers to go forth in the service of the Home Missionary and Foreign Missionary Society. The office in question was the Office of Deaconess, and I don't have time here to expound upon the history of Lucy Ryder Meyer and the deaconess structures, save to say that the Order of Deaconess is one that many of you remember with honor and with joy as I do. It enabled women to become special in the sense that though they could not be ordained, nevertheless, they were set aside by the conference in a particular way for the service of the church. When I was a child, my father was district superintendent of the Cleveland District, and the West Side Community House in Cleveland at 3000 Bridge Street was the center in which the deaconesses lived in Cleveland. There were about 25 of them, led by Miss Oram. Some of you here remember Miss Oram. The Oram Cottages faces Central Park up here just near Cedar Street. And we used to go over there and have dinner with the ladies. They lived together in one community on the third and fourth floor of that building. They worked in the community house, but they also scattered all across the city. About 8:30 in the morning, if you were on West Bridge Street, you saw the ladies come out, headed this way, that way, that way, to the various public transit systems, and many of them wouldn't be home till 10 o'clock that night. They lived together, they ate their evening meal together when possible, though that often wasn't possible. More important, they prayed together. And their consciousness of the work of God in their lives came out of that common life and of that common community. The kids in the neighborhood, conscious of the costume which the deaconesses characteristically wore, which was a full-length black garment that went all the way to the ground with a little white dicky up here at the front, at the top, used to refer to the ladies as the penguins. And there were a number of them that were a bit overweight, and they did waddle a little bit. The similarity was striking. But their service to the church and to the mission boards was a remarkable one. The recruitment of deaconesses for practical purposes ended with the possibility of ordination of women into the church in 1956. Now, so far I have been talking about church women who found a way inside the structures of the church to deal with the problems of other women which they viewed. I want to talk now about two women in succession who came to the conclusion that the problem in question could not be dealt with on a denominational basis, that one needed to go beyond the single denomination into a multiple denomination and supported structure. In Statuary Hall, in the nation's capital, every state in the Union has been permitted to place a statue of its favorite son. One state, only one. One state has chosen a favorite daughter. That state is Illinois. Her name was Frances Willard. When in 1948, the plans for the new chapel at Boston University School of Theology were well along, it was determined that one of the two new clear story windows in the chapel would need to be representation of a woman. The faculty chose Frances Willard. Frances Willard is remembered as the brilliant leader of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And sometimes in the modern day, when the institutions and organizations of the 19th century are rather indistinct to us, we don't make a distinction between the Anti-Saloon League and the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And particularly, we don't remember that the Women's Christian Temperance Union in her day had a far broader concern for the needs of women and the problems of women than just the matter of temperance, though temperance was a serious matter to them. For Frances Willard, women's rights in the far broader sense was the real passion of her life. In process of growing up and gaining an education, she traveled widely. She saw the sorry state of women in Europe and America, and she became teacher, then president of Evanston College for Ladies, and later dean of women at Northwestern University, because she was persuaded that education is one key to the raising of women within the society. In her time also, it seemed to her that one of the major elements contributing to the suppression of women was attitudes of male dominance aggravated by the excessive use of hard drink. Indeed, it seemed to her that evil as the effects of the liquor were on the man who drank it, destroying his health and the like, even more evil, she said, were the homes wrecked and the impact upon wives and children multiplied many times over when the man of the house was unable to earn a living or mistreated his family when he was drunk. So it was in mid-career, Frances Willard became a wandering evangelist for conversion from strong drink and for the conversion of a society which discriminated regularly against women. She was an evangelist in other areas than strong drink. Demon rum, she believed, could best be chained by local option. That is, by local governments in towns, in counties, and in states who outlawed the use of alcohol within their territory. If you're going to get local option, you've got to have as many votes in favor of local option as possible, and that makes it important that women vote. And so votes for women was also one of her causes. Women's rights as workers, she believed, would not be adequately recognized by employers on their own. Can you imagine it? In the 1880s, it was sometimes true that women were paid less money for doing the same work that men were. I see some of you can imagine that. Well, she was conscious of it as a problem and as a difficulty. And she was persuaded that the only way to change that situation was the labor union movement. And so she's a labor unionist in this period as well. She was born and bred a Methodist. She loved her church even when its male leadership refused her the platform of the General Conference to defend the WCTU in 1880. And when the same General Conference four years later forbade her the seat at the General Conference to which she had been elected by the Rock River Conference and sent her home without ever seating her as a delegate. But even though she was angry with her church at times, she also loved her mother church. And she believed that it could be brought in time to a better understanding. I love my mother church so well. I recognize so thoroughly the base and body of the great pyramid she forms are broader than its apex. That's a slam at the bishops if you don't recognize it. I recognize so thoroughly the base and body of the great pyramid she forms are broader than its apex, that I would fain give her a little more time in which to deal justly by the great household of her loving, loyal, and devoted daughters. I would wait in fervent hope and prayer that the great body of her ministers and of her membership may make it manifest to the world that the Church of Lady Huntington, Barbara Heck, Phoebe Palmer does not hesitate to march with the progressive age. It has done so much to bring to pass. Tragically, she had been 6 years dead when in 1904 the church admitted the first woman to General Conference. Anna Howard Shaw, the last of the ladies I want to talk about this morning. Anna Howard Shaw was born in 1847 in England, but she was raised on the Michigan frontier, where her father's irresponsibility and her mother's illness made her at age 14 the head of a family of five younger children, whom she raised and cared for and eventually got through school. She did not go to college herself until age 26 because she'd gotten all of her younger brothers and sisters through high school before she felt she had a right to try to spend any of the money she raised or earned on herself. At Albion College flowered the talent for public speaking that was to be her greatest ability. It was trained in debate class. A local district superintendent heard her preach, or heard her speak in debate class, and invited her to preach in one of the Methodist churches nearby. She came on to Boston University School of Theology for theological study, only the second woman so to do so. And on completion of her degree in 1878, she applied for ordination in the Methodist Episcopal Church, and she was turned down promptly and very emphatically. The Methodist Protestant Church, one of the denominations of the five denominations that eventually ended up in the United Methodists, the Methodist Protestant Church were more accommodating. She was one of a small group of women in the 70s and 80s who were ordained into the Methodist Protestant clergy. Interestingly, none of those women served Methodist Protestant parishes. The Methodist Protestants ordained them and then turned them loose. And she ended up serving two little parishes, one a Baptist and the other a non-denominational church at Dennis on Cape Cod. Her sound theological training led her to question many of the givens of American life in the late 19th century, not least of these, the position of women in society. She earned much of the money to go through school by giving temperance addresses, that is, going out and for 50 cents giving an address for the Women's Christian Temperance Union. It is this that brought her to Frances Willard's attention, and Frances Willard eventually hired her away from the two churches where she had been serving to serve as a lecturer for the Women's Christian Temperance Union full-time. Incidentally, in the interim between the time she graduated from seminary and the time she went to work for the WCTU, she became the first woman graduate of Boston University School of Medicine as well. Dr. Shaw was quite a woman. She spoke regularly for the WCTU for a couple of years, And in the process met Susan B. Anthony. And Susan Anthony was looking, in essence, for an heir and successor in the National American Women's Suffrage Association. And in due time, Ms. Shaw became the head of, for 11 years, the head of the women's suffrage struggle in the opening years of the 19th century. When she retired because of ill health in 1915, the women's suffrage amendment to the Constitution was still 3 years away. But she had created the organization and the structure that would eventually achieve that amendment. Because in state after state after state, she fought the battle and created a political structure to fight the battle to get women's right to vote in a given state or in a given territory. And eventually there will be enough territories and states so won to carry a national amendment to the Constitution. Her national stature is testified to by the fact that when President Wilson was approached by Secretary of War Newton D. Baker in the First World War about the appointment of a head for the Women's Committee of the Council of National Defense, that's in 1917, he wrote back to Newton Baker, "I don't care who else is on the committee, but it must be chaired by Anna Howard Shaw." When the war was over, once again, she took to the stump. Now over 70 and weakened by a lifetime of steady travel and labor, she would campaign again, not for suffrage now, that battle was won, not for temperance, for the 18th Amendment had also been passed, but now she would fight for that right without which all of the other rights of women are vain. The right to raise one's family in peace. Responding to personal appeals from President Wilson and former President Taft, she went forth to lecture in support of the League of Nations. And in that last campaign, still in harness as it were, she suffered the heart attack that closed her life. The honor roll of Methodist women is long. Susanna Wesley, Grace Murray Bennett, Mary Bosanquet Fletcher, Sarah Crosby, Selina Countess of Huntingdon, Barbara Heck, Lois Lee Parker, Isabella Thoburn, Sarah Dickey, Jenny Carvel Culver Hartzell, Frances Willard, Anna Howard Shaw, Lucy Ryder Meyer, and on and on and on. And the three bishops that have been elected to the episcopacy from our female membership in the course of the last 5 years are simply the latest examples of the leadership and the capacity of Methodist women. The record stands as a challenge. It stands as a challenge to men who still in the 1980s would argue against the place of women in ministry. It stands as a challenge to women to meet the demands of the 80s with as much grace and as much power and as much determination as did the women of another era and another time meet the problems of their time. But most of all, it stands as a challenge to the United Methodist Church to recognize the personhood and the capacity of its female constituency, and to enable and support that constituency as it moves to the achievement of that which, by the grace of God, it has the power to become. May God make it so.